You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel.
Coming up this week in episode 263, we look back at Glastonbury and discuss whether Adele should offer the audience a refund. The England football team are back home early as usual. We review week 3 of Euro 2016 and we'll reveal the best children's television programmes of all time. Paddington better be in there. That's all coming up after the Dandy Warhols and Bohemian Like You.
From Portland, Oregon, the Dandy Warhols, and a single released an astonishing 17 years ago.
Wow, really?
17 years. Bohemian Like You. Welcome to the Parish Council podcast, episode 263.
Hooray!
Hooray! Brought to you by the Media Motel. I'm Terence Ronald Anthony St. Joseph Dackham, and is she bohemian? Is she like you? She's Juliet Lucy Harris.
The question number one, probably not. And question number two, definitely not, I think.
Jules, Adele. Adele should refund everyone who was in the audience at Glastonbury last Saturday. I'll tell you why.
I do very much enjoy your very measured pronouncements that we sometimes have on this show. They're always incredibly balanced and not at all inflammatory.
Absolutely. No. There's a very fair point I'm making here. If I go to see, for example, Mark Rylance playing a major role, let's say Mark Antony in Julius Caesar, I don't expect him to turn to the audience and say, OK, everybody, say it along with me. Friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. and then point the microphone at the audience as they,
I would happily help Mark Rylance, but yes, I take your point.
Yeah, you know, they start bellowing, "I come to bury Caesar, not to praise him." It just wouldn't happen. Mm. Similarly, anyone attending the ballet at the Royal Opera House would be surprised if Odette in Swan Lake again turned to the audience and said, "Well, anyone brought their dancing shoes? Come on up and have a go." So if I've paid £228 plus £5 booking fee, of course, to see Adele Glass.
Is that how much it is for a Glastonbury ticket now?
£228 this year in 2016.
I thought it was. Plus, I'm still working on the old 180 figure, which I thought was extortionate anyway.
£228 this year plus £5 booking fee before you even. That's without car parking.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So if I've paid that to see Adele at Glastonbury, I want to see and hear her perform her songs, not a kind of tuneless multiple karaoke of 100,000 people in the crowd. It's not just Adele, I know this. Coldplay did it. Lots of artists do it. But Jules, the have-a-go sing-along, it's wrong and it has to stop.
And everyone must be locked up in some sort of Glastonbury-based gulag before they're allowed to be let free. Predictably, I have slightly less of a problem with this than you do. But then said that, well, firstly, factually, you haven't just paid 220, whatever it is, plus £5 booking fee to see Adele. You've paid that for the entire festival. So if that is annoying you, you are, of course, very welcome to go and see other artists that are performing throughout the site.
Oh, right. Okay.
Having said that, yes, okay. I accept that you might not necessarily be buying this as an argument. no, I agree. It's extremely irritating. My dad has a sort of very long antipathy towards Robbie Williams for similar reasons. His problem with Robbie Williams is he's a bit needier than Adele when it comes to encouraging people, into the point where my dad says, "Robbie Williams, if you're having to interrupt your set every other sentence to say, 'Are you with me? Are you with me?' the chances are your audience are not, and you are panicking about it. However deep you're burying it behind Robbie Williams' kind of, comedy clown act that he seems to adopt." Mm-hmm. I think Glastonbury has always had moments of communality. That's even a word. It's always had big moments of communal singing. And that's always, when watching it on telly, that's always been very, very fun and heartening to watch, because it feels special and it feels like a kind of a special experience. Having said that, though, if you over-egg that particular pudding, it stops being special and it loses its impact. I really like Adele. I think she's great. I think she's a terrific performer. I thought she had a fantastic rapport with that audience. I thought it was really very enjoyable. My mum, who comes from London, is of the view that nobody quite speaks as London as Adele does. It is slightly put on. Having said that, hello! No one really kind of speaks like that all the time, no. I don't think. But having said that, I do think she's terrific. I do like Adele a great deal, actually, as a kind of a character. I'm hugely entertained by her. Having said that, though, yes, it would have been nice to have heard a bit more of Adele, because Adele does have a fantastic voice, which is why everyone wants to go and see her. So I'm not quite as crotchety about it as you are. But having said that, I can see it, but then Glastonbury is a festival, and I suppose Glastonbury tries to be an event, doesn't it? It tries to be something special. And I suppose that Adele's getting everybody to join in and to feel part of the moment is trying to feed into that, I think.
Well, let's compare and contrast, because the charismatic figure of PJ Harvey performed at Glastonbury turned in quite a performance without holding the microphone
without interacting at all at the crowd, really.
She
barely speaks at all nowadays. I mean, I saw her performing about, 2004, I think, and she, her in between song, quote unquote, bants, consisted of her saying thank you very much. So yes, and
that's the other extreme.
It is, actually. Maybe the truth is somewhere in between. Having said that, as our resident PJ Harvey correspondent, I suppose I ought to give my thoughts on PJ Harvey's set. She weirdly, although you would think that PJ Harvey and Adele don't have an awful lot in common, PJ Harvey was putting on just as much of a show as Adele was putting on, but it was a completely different kind of show. So the nub of Adele's show is that her songs have it, and I think this perhaps comes down to Adele's songs. Adele's songs are enormous, not just in their size, but also in that, Adele has just shifted millions of units around the world in an age where no one really does that anymore, or at least it's less likely. And that's because her songs, she's one of these universal truth artists. Ironically, I would put her with Coldplay, who are another headliner, and U2. She seems to be able to find something. They get criticised for being bland, but she seems to be able to find something that an awful lot of people can relate to. So that maybe that's why Adele's always kind of, you know, getting on to sing along, because the root of Adele's kind of persona and show is that she is very approachable and that everyone is experiencing together. Whereas PJ Harvey is completely different because she is putting on a show. But PJ Harvey's show, you know, again, it was largely, the set largely consisted of the two most recent albums, which is Hope Six Demolition Project, which came out earlier this year, and Let England Shake, which came out in 2011, and she won the Mercury Music Prize for that album for the second time, somewhat unbelievably. She's won it in 2001 and 2011, so I hope she's preparing for 2021 as we speak. but she was, you know, it was a costumed set, really. She came in sort of all dressed up with feathers in her hair. My mum's obsessed with the idea that she's kind of the new version of Judy Felix, which is one for our older listeners, I suspect. But she came on with all of the male backing band all dressed in suits. I mean, so that was very much a performance and a show. But that her nub is that, of course, she is creating art. That's very much what PJ Harvey is doing nowadays. So and I suppose consciously creating art with a capital C, capital A. But I thought it was a terrific performance. I thought it was, she did 50 Foot Queenie, and the last time she did that, I think, at Glastonbury, or the version that people remember her for doing it, was the pink catsuit, the infamous pink catsuit set in 1995, so 21 years ago. Wow. So to still be holding an audience's attention at Glastonbury. Admittedly, she's on the other stage now, not the main stage, but...
Yes, I wonder what. Why wasn't she on the main stage?
She was quite late up on the other stage in that she was at 7:30. So that's getting on for evening.
There wasn't a huge crowd there, though. I know there was a sizable attendance.
Yes,
but you know,
it wasn't enormous. Though, having said that, she's. It's weird. She's always been a little bit of a cult concern, or a kind of a critical concern, in that, you know, if you were really into your music, you really liked PJ Harvey, and critically her albums did very well. She seems to have crossed over now to the point where after 24 years after Dry came out in 1992, overnight success, PJ Harvey scores a number one album for the first time. So she seems to have crossed over now and become, I mean, put it this way, her set was not live, but her set was recorded and televised on BBC4 at 9:00, which is prime time for a certain kind of audience, if you see what I mean. I think that's where PJ Harvey has reached now, where she's never necessarily going to be a stadium filler, and maybe that's why.
I mean, maybe so.
Because she was on the main stage for Pink Catsuit in 95, but having said that, that year was a slightly confused year, and then that was the year that the Stone Roses pulled out and Pulp had headline, I think, so, unless I've got that wrong. But
I just worry about her a little bit as well, in a very fatherly way.
Very
and I don't
thin. You're going to say she's very
so
thin.
Thin.
Yes, my mum said that.
So
then
thin.
Then she has always been very thin.
And she's never been a stout girl, no, but I mean...
And she's very, very small in real life as well. She's about 5'1". I've never seen her perform without wearing the most sort of death-defying of heels. She's got enormous shoes that she wears. And she, although she was talking, I saw her talk to Jules Holland when she went on late, well, she's been on later many times, but I think when she was doing Storage in the City, she went on with him. I remember my dad being hugely entertained that, again, she had this enormously loud backing band and she was belting out songs like Big Exit and Stomping Around and, you know, all in suits, and she was in a suit as well and really kind of powerful. And my dad said to me, God, you've got this woman belting out these songs and she's from Yeovil. I mean, my dad is really entertained that, you know, sort of the journey that she's been on. But she was talking to Jules Holland about the fact that she's not very tall, and she did the American, that was when she was sort of at her poppiest, and she did the American chat shows, and I think she did Letterman, and she said that Arnold Schwarzenegger was on. And not necessarily the most obvious meeting of minds, PJ Harvey and Arnold Schwarzenegger. And Jules Holland said, oh, what was he like? And PJ Harvey came up with a wonderful line. He said a lot of very nice things in a very odd accent. And then said, when they stood next to each other and she took her heels off, Arnold Schwarzenegger was the same height as PJ Harvey.
No.
Or maybe she still had her heels on. But she said, basically, when she stood next to him, they were of a very similar height. So actually, the Terminator is in real life very small. So
Tom Cruise.
Yes,
syndrome
I think
thing.
So. So, but yes, if anybody hasn't seen the PJ Harvey set, it's really worth trying to look it up on iPlayer. It will still be there, I think, because
I watched it last night again. Yeah, it's still
there. I watched it a couple of times simply because the thing that really struck me with it. I mean, firstly, I think our friend Adrian said on Twitter that the set of songs that she's got at the moment is really quite tight. I mean, my mum watched it begrudgingly in another house because I said to her it was on, I was going to watch it, and my mum said actually, her music, even to a neutral, is really quite entertaining now. There's something very eccentric and something very unique about it. She's found a sound for a bit. And usually for her, she's kept the same sound across two albums pretty much, which she doesn't usually do. And it seems like she's sort of found her sort of niche that she wants to. She's here now. She wants to explore this for as long as she can. But the thing that interested me was, what with, you know, the political situation worldwide, Europe, in Britain even, she seemed to hit the right note. She seemed to be the kind of the soundtrack of the time, really, to sing "The World's Asleep, Let England Shake, England's Dancing Days Are Done" of this weekend, of all weekends, was of a song that she wrote 5 years ago, was just the way in which it fell in with its time made it the performance of the weekend for me, not just because it was always going to be for me because I love PJ Harvey, but because I thought it was, and the way they all walked onto the stage at the beginning, it was superb. Although I did very much enjoy Tame Impala as well.
Oh yes, we love the old Tame Impala.
We played them recently around these.
We did, yeah. One aspect of live shows that none of us can fail to be aware of is that
I know what you're going to say.
Any audience will now contain a sizable number of people holding up phones or smart devices to record Adele or PJ Harvey or whoever holding the mic at the crowd. Large numbers of the audience. You know, they don't watch the stage. They look at their phones and enjoy, in inverted commas, the gig through the medium of a 4-inch screen. But already at large, at many gigs in America and bound to spread further across the globe, is Yondr, Yondr. This is a concept to stop people using phones at gigs. And as you enter the venue, your phone is placed in this locked Yondr pouch. It's a grey kind of pouch of material, but it's your phone goes in, it's locked, but you keep the pouch with you, so you don't lose control of it.
So it's not like the old system when I was doing exams at school and at university. You had to put your mobile phone on a trestle table at the front of the room, and it had a raffle ticket put on it with a rubber band, and you were then given a raffle ticket and you had to take it to your desk. Can you imagine doing that at Glastonbury?
Yeah, I know.
How do you buy a book of raffle tickets with 200,000 in it?
What you just described though happens on film sets as well. You hand in your phone, you know, in a similar fashion before you go on to set, and then you're given a kind of receipt in the form of a ticket or whatever, and then you collect it off some pale youth at the end of the day. But as you say, this is a different concept because you keep it. You keep the pouch with you. You hand it in at the end of the gig. It's unlocked, and your phone's with you, and you're on your way. I'm all for this,
I think it's ideal.
Yeah, it's surely going to be at least a temporary answer. To this, I think it's a real nuisance when you're at a gig. If you're in the audience, if you're at Glastonbury, you're looking at a load of flags.
Yes, and I found the flags particularly irritating this year, which I think is a sign that I'm getting old, I think.
When I was looking at this during the week, I read that Apple have patented a technology in similar vein. It's some form of infrared beam to block cameras temporarily in venues. I think that could be even better because people then can keep access to their phones if there's an emergency, someone can get hold of them. It's just the recording aspect would be blocked. I think one of those, you know, these sort of technologies have got to come in because it's just absurd.
It is starting to get a bit ridiculous. I think we've spoken previously and you told me the story of someone waving an iPad, which really does block out an enormous amount of vision. Yes, I agree, it is very irritating. And also, it says, I mean, we might have spoken about this before, but it says very deep things about younger people generally and how, more than ever, we don't seem to be able to experience things in person, do we? We only seem to be able to experience things. An experience isn't lived, you know, TwitPic or it didn't happen. An experience isn't lived without being recorded or documented or watched through a screen, really. And when I go to a gig, I seldom take pictures. Occasionally, if I'm particularly close to the stage. The only Gap band I ever seem to take pictures of live is I have a tradition of going to see Wire with my friend Neil in very small venues. They often use the Brighton and Lewis area to wait to sort of warm up in. So often I end up finding myself 10 feet away from Colin Newman more often than not. And so I take pictures of them. But otherwise, I'm living it. I'm being at the gig. I don't need to take a picture of Brett Anderson or PJ Harvey or whoever having the gig of their life. I want to watch it. I want to be able to remember it.
I don't even begrudge the odd photo, but you get people holding up their phones recording video. Yeah, for the whole gig, and not just one or two, you know, a sizable number. And, of course, they tend to want to be at the front in order to get the best possible picture. So, therefore, the first 10, 15 rows of any major gig, people swaying phones. England collapsed out of Euro 2016 in the most insipid manner.
In the least predictable news ever,
yes. But Wales have reached the semi-finals. Our Euro 2016 update is next after Catatonia. It's what's not there that makes what's
band there. That's yes. Catatonia and What It Is, which I picked as a sort of just a vague kind of comment on the political situation, which we're not talking about at all this week, which is very welcome indeed. But yeah, that's from their their Papers, Scissors, Stone album, which was their kind of, they had International Velvet was the big record, and I think it was 97 that came out, 98, and then they had Equally Cursed and Blessed, which is a follow-up, and then that was after Equally Cursed and Blessed, and I think that was pretty much the end of Catatonia, that album, which is a shame because I think it's very underrated in places. And I think that song that's kind of got a drum and bass element, whenever someone, if you'd said to me, oh, it's an indie band, they're going drum and bass, I would have thought, oh my god, that's going to sound awful. But actually I think it's rather dignified and rather good.
I think we're a little oasis this week away from the world of referenda, Conservative and Labour, British politics. I think we'll give everybody a, yes, a bit of a rest.
I think we all need a bit of a rest, frankly. Yes. So let's talk about football. That's always
week three, Jules, indeed. Week three of Euro 2016, and we're nearly at the semi-final stage. Naturally, the England team are nowhere in sight, but Wales march on.
They do, and gloriously so.
Gloriously against Belgium last night. Today for us is Saturday, the 2nd of July. Jules, from England's perspective, for me, that's like what I thought I'd throw that in because that's what Glenn Hoddle says at the start. For me, it wasn't that we lost to Iceland so much. Good luck to them.
Yeah, absolutely. Because we've been fans of Iceland throughout.
Oh, absolutely. They were my outsiders for the tournament I picked before
you
the thing
did.
Started.
You very much did. The Leicester of Euro 2016. Indeed. That are playing as a team and winning as a team.
Exactly. From our point of view, England, it was the all too familiar sense of entitlement, yes, before they get on the pitch. Yeah. All the swaggering hubris of Daniel Sturridge and Joe Hart with their Dr. Dre headphones and kind of contempt for the media as they sort of strut through the mix zone. They sweep along with all that false bravado. It reminds me, it's like little Alan Sugar when he prances, yes, into the stock exchange to tell apprentice candidates about their next task. Though as soon, of course, as the players emerge into the tunnel, they look like frightened toddlers. Mm. Despite Joe Hart's misguided bellowing, which must add to their terror, I think, rather than calming them down.
Well, yes, exactly. And also, if you are going to shout your lungs off, can you make sure you can catch a ball that's rolling across the floor if you're a goalkeeper? That would be more of a help, I feel.
I think that would aid the team more, yes. An England team, Jules, that simply cannot compete at a moderate level, and a succession of managers who've all been unable to effect a change. What's to be done,
well,
Jules?
Well, true, although whilst it's you know, unfair to necessarily bash one manager, the sad reality is, and I think we said this a couple of weeks ago, that, you know, Hodgson was right to go, because if he'd failed, and then he's had three major tournaments in charge. He's had the 2012 Euro 2012, the 2014 World Cup, and now you know, Euro 2016. There's been no progress at all that I can particularly put my finger on. They've played quite well at times in qualifiers and friendlies, and then that progress is never sustained. Major tournaments are the whole atmosphere around England is wrong, and I actually, one of the problems is that, like you say, that they are so shut away. I mean, and they don't show respect for the opposition. The idea that Ray Lewington and Roy Hodgson, the manager and his sort of main assistant, did not watch.
They didn't bother.
They didn't watch Iceland play because they went on a boat trip to Paris they went on a boat trip on the scene because Roy had never seen Paris. And you just think, for goodness sake, I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous. I mean, I'm glad that Roy Hodgson has gone. Doesn't it tell a story that within seconds of losing, he went straight into a media room and read from a pre-prepared statement? Doesn't that sum it all up?
It says it all. It does indeed.
In its own way. And you know, no wonder everybody's longing for a Slaven, aren't we? Or somebody like that. Someone that's actually...
Oh, these blokes with their blazers and their badges on their...
And that's FA culture, isn't it, really? Oh. And we keep being told that it's going to change. And there have been changes. But when you think that Iceland, I know that Iceland is a much, much smaller nation, so it's not that the size of Coventry, we were told repeatedly on the commentary. I know it's a much smaller nation, but I read a statistic along the lines that Iceland have one UEFA qualified coach for something like every 17 people, and England have one for every 11,000 to 12,000. Mm. So, I mean, I know that it's a smaller country, but the problems, I think, partly because the manager is uninspiring. I can't imagine Roy Hodgson pumping me up to want to play very much. But it's also, like we say,
he's the John Major of football
management. He is. You're waiting for the next leap forward with him, and it never seems to quite come. So I don't think Roy Hodgson is inspiring, but the idea that the problem is at grassroots level, and I think there are changes being done there, but it's a bit like turning an oil tank around, I think, and of course lots of England's problems came as well. Are we not making defenders anymore? Are we not training them? Is that a thing that we've stopped doing? Because we just don't seem. And of course, the problem is that I think this to some extent comes from Roy Hodgson. If you're a manager, you've got to manage, and managing, I know this sounds like some awful New Labour focus group, but it really means inspiring. And if your manager patently does not know his best team, patently does not know the position in which he wants to play players, and patently does not really know what he wants to do, yeah, I think most of the players were abject, but you can't really blame them. If they're not being guided as to what it is they've got to do, and they don't have confidence in where they're being led, it's no wonder they all don't have any idea at all when they get on the pitch, and England just look aimless and directionless most of the time. Harry Kane looked exhausted. He looked like someone that had played, 111 games in two seasons or something. Although I don't know if this is true or not, but there was one of the Icelandic players claims that Harry Kane asked the referee in the tunnel at half-time, if England lost, did it mean they were knocked out?
I know. I hope it's not true, but there's a part of me that kind of fears that that's exactly what
Although
happened.
If it's any consolation for Harry Kane, speaking of people misunderstanding questions and circumstances they're in, I was reading a review of the Ab Fab film the other day, and it had the apocryphal tale. I hope it's not true, but I suspect it probably is. Kate Moss was participating in a fashion shoot someone wants in a tower block, and she could use the toilet, and she was told by one of the people running the show, oh yes, she could, there were a set round the corner, but to be careful because they didn't have any doors. To which Kate Moss replied, well, how am I supposed to get in them then?
Yes, that's right. So, I heard that story.
Kate Moss and Harry Kane, the intellectual colossi of our age, yes.
Talking of ill-advised footballers, though, now I know everybody's been on Raheem Sterling's back, and this is not personal at all, but the day after returning from the abject failure, suddenly on what you young people call, I think, Snapchat or Instagram or something, an ill-judged video on social media, preening his way around some jewel-encrusted mansion that he bought for his mother. You know, just a day or two after proving that his football kit consists of the emperor's new clothes.
Yes.
It was just another example of the smug, big, I am coterie of England players. It's all peacock pomp until it actually comes to playing football.
And
the part of his life that he actually gets paid for.
Absolutely, although perhaps not for that much longer, maybe. I don't know. But maybe the problem is money, that they're paid as such that they then live completely remote lifestyles. Maybe the problem that they're too cosseted. The Manchester United chef story about one of the players that asked him to boil eggs for him because he didn't know how to do it at home, you know, all of that kind of stuff. I'm not sure if we've reached kind of peak football in that sense, that we've reached kind of peak rage. I mean, I've long had a theory that England should be taking a team of championship players to major tournaments. They'll be pleased to play for their country. They'll give it a go, and they'll get to the semi-finals before anybody even knows who the hell they are. And actually,
that's a very reasonable point.
And actually, that's in a way that's almost the Iceland or the Wales approach, isn't it? Really, because some of Wales's players. I mean, one of Wales is, isn't it? Was it Wales or Ireland? One of their players didn't even have a club when they joined when they started the tournament.
Carnu Robson, the Welsh scorer from last night, was let go by Reading,
and then goes on to the and then plays on the world
this
stage
summer,
in an amazing way. So actually, that's Robson, what Wales Carnu, are doing. I think it's incredible.
And last thing on the manager, why? And you've alluded to it almost there. Why bother with a manager at all? Iceland beat us by employing a dentist to manage the team.
Oh yes, of course.
Don't bother with a manager. Maybe if we beat Tenerife or Liechtenstein to qualify for a tournament, perhaps ask Arsene Wenger or Mauricio Pochettino just to step in and coach the team during the tournament. Why not? Permanent managers haven't worked. And by the way, though, if the FA in their blazed glory, do employ a new full-time manager, insist that he goes to watch players in league games, that he stays to the end of the game.
We talked about this before.
I know I've mentioned this before, but the number of times, I just got to get this off my chest.
Do it, man.
Martin Tyler says, oh, there's Roy Hodgson in the director's box. Perhaps he's here to see, watch Dele Alli or Eric Dyer. And then at about the 75th minute, the camera cuts to Hodgson shaking hands with Daniel Levy and legging it to beat the traffic, I'm assuming. It's your job if you're the manager. Stay to the end. A surgeon can't get halfway through plonking a new heart in someone's chest and say, I say, nurse, take over, would you? The traffic on the M25 will be horrendous if I don't get away now. No other job, you can't do it. You can't get three quarters of the way through the sale of a house and just say,
actually,
pretty rough traffic down on the South Coast this week. I'll leave it there. Good luck to you all. Yeah. You can't do it.
It's fine.
you can't. But you're just putting your last few items on the conveyor belt in Waitrose, and the lady on the till says, tell you what, I fancy a fag. I'm going outside. You finish it off yourself. It just, why football managers and why Hodgson in particular thinks that it's perfectly okay. It's his job. Stay to the end.
I know. And that's the thing. Roy Hodgson doesn't strike me as someone that is absolutely enthused to be doing that job, really. And as someone put it on Twitter, I mean, we've spoken previously, haven't we, about the fact that Roy Hodgson was an innovative and successful manager in the 90s, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to translate now. And someone put on Twitter, apologies to Liverpool fans everywhere, you weren't being too harsh on Roy Hodgson.
No, exactly. So he was completely out of touch with the modern era. We said it before the tournament, and I think sadly
we couldn't have improved more. Right. Whereas Wales, on the other hand, I mean, when you watch Chris Coleman being interviewed, you just think, Wales are such an inspiring story. And also, of course, you know, the name Gary Speed comes up from time to time. And what a wonderful story. And you know, it made me quite emotional yesterday when you've got the manager telling people to dream big and to work hard and never give up. And then you've got the captain festooned in his very many children. I just thought it was, you know, Wales seem to have an emotional heart to them, really. And that's how they're doing it. Like Leicester, it's Leicester all over again. It's everybody playing for each other. And I mean, I hope that they do beat Portugal in the next round. The problem is that they are without two quite strong players. They're without Ramsey and they're without, I can't remember who the other one was, but who are on second yellows. There was a sort of a chat about it with the people in the chairs where they said that to be suspended for two yellows in five matches,
it's very harsh.
Well, I thought that in most tournaments they get wiped off after the
as ever, there's very complicated rules about amnesties. It depends when you get booked. They get wiped off after the quarterfinal stage. If you got one in the knockout, aspect. It's very, very complicated. But Ramsey unfortunately didn't qualify for the amnesty.
I am sorry to hear that. But we wish Wales all the best. I mean, of course, they are. It depends. Which Ronald are they going to get? Good Ronald or bad Ronald? If they get bad Ronald, then they'll probably win. The Ronaldo, but my family always calls him Ronald, and I can't resist because it does puncture his ridiculousness a bit. So will they get the Ronald that doesn't show up and just misses penalties at major tournaments, or will they get the Ronald that burns through teams and scores two or three goals at a time? I'd hope for Wales' sake they get bad Ronald.
I hope so too. The creator of Trumpton died this week. We'll be considering the impact on Chippy Minton and his son Nibs and Miss Lovelace and her Pekingese. That's right after this gorgeous track from the Clientele. Kids all jump in bonfires on me. Kids all jump in bonfires on me. on my daily playlist for the last few weeks, and it's a new discovery for me. The title track from their 2009 album, that's The Clientele, and lovely Bonfires on the Heath.
Yeah, I really like The Clientele. I've played some of their stuff before on the radio, I think, and it's really lovely stuff.
This week we learned of the death at the age of 95 of the producer and puppeteer Gordon Murray. Not a well-known name, but when I tell you he was responsible for the Trumptonshire trilogy, Camberwick Green, Trumpton and Chigley, you'll know why he was held in such high regard. Now, George, you're too young to have seen Trumpton first time round, but was your childhood spent at all with Pew Pew, Barney McGrew, Cuthbert Dibble and
Yes,
Grub?
Yes, actually. I did. When I was very little, we had my stories always seem to have ridiculous levels of detail to them, but there was one of our next door neighbours called Alan had a daughter that worked in a video shop called Parkstone Videos, and so we used to go up to Parkstone Parade, which was this rather sort of dingy parade of shops, and there was a shop where I bought my football stickers, for example, and also a spa and places. A spa with no R on the end, by the way, for our middle class listeners there. You can also go to, or rather a spa with an R on the end, rather than, you know, a health spa. It's a place where you buy discount lemonade. So we went to this video shop, and I was often allowed to hire a video out every couple of weeks or so. And I did hire out Trumpton and Camberwick Green once and watched it, and I thought it was great. I really enjoyed it. Windy Miller and all that kind of stuff. I thought it was terrific. So I missed it the first time round, but I did very much enjoy watching it. And also in the news again recently, because Radiohead's Burn the Witch, their video for the first song off the Moonshaped Pool album, did have sort of Trumpton vibes going on, and Gordon's family actually complained vociferously about it and threatened legal action. So
they did indeed. I was sorry when I read his obituary in of course, the Telegraph yesterday.
Your Telegraph, yeah.
Yes, my Telegraph. I was sorry to see that he had a sort of a bit of a fit of pique in the 80s when Trumpton's popularity waned a little, and he constructed a bonfire in his garden and chucked all the original figures
onto the fire. That's one way of dealing with things, isn't it?
But saddened me. Yes, it is indeed. Yeah, we thought we'd look back and each pick our top three children's TV shows of all time to coincide with this Trumpton news. What's in third place on your winner's podium?
Well, my winner's podium. I didn't necessarily pick a top three. I picked three that were equal. So
they can all be joint. They can all be joint winners.
Absolutely.
That's okay.
So the first thing I'll talk about then is Rainbow, which is a program which seemed to have a really long shelf life. Actually, it seemed to go on for a very long time. I mean, and again, this is the bit where I'm going to have to admit my age, and I don't mind, but it seems to depress everybody else, which is a pity. But I was born in 1984, so my memories of Rainbow, I would have been watching it around 1988, 1989. They're not to be confused with the rock band of the same name, by the way. I'm just looking at I'm trying to look up when it started. It's basically a program that had a presenter called Jeffrey when I used to watch it, and also had Bungle, Zippy and George, who were puppets, and people that were around during the 70s and the 80s and the early 90s will of course remember Rod, Jane and Freddie, the slightly creepy but entertaining trio that used to turn up and do lots of singing and that sort of thing. It started off in 1972, I think, and stopped in the original release, it says, was 1972 to 1992. So it had a good run of about 20 years, pretty much. It ended very abruptly because Thames TV lost its ITV franchise. But I loved Rainbow. I loved the characters. I mean, yes, you can look back on Bungle, Zippy and George now, and you know, lots of people have sort of read various things into it. George will always be the campest puppet on children's TV ever, who was a slightly effete pink hippo. But I loved it. If I look back on my childhood, a lot of my childhood seems to be watching Rainbow and reading Rainbow annuals. I've still got them somewhere. And Rainbow comic was the highlight of my week as a small child. You could always go and buy. I regret having given away 104 issues of Rainbow comic once. That was a pity. But Rainbow had quite a large impact on my childhood generally, I think. It was also perhaps because it was the late 80s, early 90s, it was a move towards I don't know, maybe it was a move towards the modern kind of era now of there being sort of spin-offs and merchandise and things surrounding TV programmes. I don't know if that I don't think it was the first to do that, but it was certainly a sign of the times, I think.
Hugely enjoyable. And of course, lovely Rod, Jane and Freddie. And I don't know if you know this, but Jane and Freddie of Rod, Jane and Freddie got married.
Yes, I did know that.
Yeah, in May, after 30 years, 30 years after their first appearances in Rainbow. Good old Jane and Freddie.
Congratulations. I had no idea they'd only just got married. I thought they'd been married years, to be honest.
No, they got married over the Maybank holiday this year. In 2016, 30 years after starting their performances on Rainbow. I mean, that's quite some engagement.
Their parents must have been pretty despairing, wouldn't they?
Yes. So finally, they thought, oh, we'll get round to it. There's a slight twist for me with Rainbow because I sort of associated it with being home from school ill. But it was a huge job. The only thing was the bear, Bungle. Yes. I'm never quite sure if he, she, boy or a girl.
I always considered him to be a chap, but maybe I'm wrong.
There's the only negative element to me about Rainbow is that Bungle, a touch scary, possibly because it's a bear. Look out, it's a bear.
Because I love bears. I am a big fan of, much of my Facebook is turning into me posting up videos of various bears. So I am, unfortunately, I am a bear fan. But yes, he did have rather a sort of a frowny visage, didn't he, really?
Yes, a little bit scary,
yes,
I have to say.
So what's your number three, then?
Yeah, I've got an Olympic-style podium. I know everybody needs to just visualise a kind of podium with the bronze, silver and gold. So in third place, I've got Magpie, which... In the late 60s, it was the cool, slightly hippie-ish ITV alternative to the rather staid and school prefect-y Blue Peter on the BBC.
I knew you picked the punk one compared to the to Blue Peter's course. Kind of square.
Even plays the rebel, even at sort of 10 years old. And just as I fell in love with Sandy Shaw without really having the age or knowledge to understand why, here was Susan Stranks on Magpie. But she wasn't just a love interest. She showed us how to do things. She was a really empowering woman. Mm. And she showed us how to do things and talked about issues that might affect us. The sort of thing that you didn't get on Blue Peter. And Magpie went beyond the sort of cuddly pets and coat hangers, Christmas decorations made out of coat hangers, that sort of thing. And it became even more influential to me when the rather odd Tony Bastable with his UKIP-y political views was replaced by the super cool Mick Robinson. Mick Robinson with it, Mark Bolan hair.
Yes.
He was essentially a pop star presiding over a children's television show. The number three, Magpie.
Yes, indeed. And I've just sort of looked it up because I had some familiarity with it. My two favourite facts about Magpie. The show's mascot was a magpie called Murgatroyd, which is a fantastically obscure name. And also theme tune played by the Spencer Davis Group.
There you go.
And alias of the Murgatroyd Band.
Talk about hip as opposed
Absolutely.
To Peter with their sort of tank tops and safe method of producing things with old kitchen rolls.
Yes, absolutely.
And completely different world on Magpie.
They also had a habit of adopting sort of vehicles. So they adopted a steam engine and renamed her Magpie. And again, that was a nod to Blue Peter, who had a locomotive with the same name as the show. It's still being used on the North Yorkshire Moors Railway today, apparently, although without the name. And Magpie, I do love Wikipedia's po-faceness. Magpie also adopted a boat originally called Mankadoo and renamed Thames Magpie. Its current whereabouts are unknown. If you or anyone have seen Mankadoo, please do get in touch.
Yes. What's your second pick, George?
Well, I'm going to pick something that's, again, nods towards the kind of more anarchic end of kids' TV, or rather the more alternative kids' TV end. It's something called Round the Bend, which was fairly short-lived, I think, if I remember correctly. I'm just sort of looking out to see exactly when it was on. So, again, this would have been something that I would have watched as a sort of a 6 or 7 year old, so late 80s, early 90s. It was a when you Google Round the Bend, you get Round the Bend Driving School, which I'm not sure I want to go to Round the Bend Driving School. It doesn't sound great, really. It was on for three series from 1989 to 1991. It was created by Tony Husband, who's a Mark Rogers. The voices included Kate Robbins. The composer and the theme tune was composed by Big George, who also composed Have I Got News for You, amongst other things.
No longer with us, sadly.
Yeah, I'm
Big
sorry
George.
To hear that. Yes, and so it was. It was basically a sort of a satirical kids TV series that was kind of meant to be. It was a parody of Saturday morning magazine shows, except it was set in a sewer. It
That's
was presented.
Right.
The anchor man was a bloke called, was a sort of a crocodile man called Doc the Croc. That was puppets. So it was Doc the Croc. And he had various sort of assistants with him. And the idea was that it was a bit like a magazine show, in that there were programs within the programs. So there were sort of cartoons and animated segments that were done by Aardman, apparently, in between. And they had all sorts of different, and I remember loving it at the time because, of course, there was a lot of toilet humour, which is, for a 5 or 6 year old, is deeply entertaining. I also had the computer game for the Amiga 500, which was extremely innovative because it was a platformer, but you jumped into newspaper pages and then played a mini game within a game. So actually it was quite innovative for its time. But just the level of detail in it, for example, that the that there was a woman that was obviously meant to be there was a rat that was meant to be a parody of Janet Street Porter, who was called Jemima Wellington Green. They have various different music video segments, again, very much toilet humour, featuring Michael Jack Dung, Elton the John, Kylie Manure and Jason Dungovan. And there were hand puppets made to look like piles of manure. They had John Potato's News Round. They had a parody of Neighbours that was called Vegetables, that had potatoes with Australian accents. I mean, it was the level of detail in it was quite something. And you can watch it all for free. There's a website online where they've uploaded them all. And that sort of things like Attack of the Atomic Banana, that a parody of Thundercats called Thunderpants. I mean, it was, you know, for perhaps it had, you know, not the subtlest humour ever, but for me, I thought it was great. And I love the idea that it's got that satirical edge. And maybe watching that as a child was a thing that got me into appreciating kind of political humour and humour that's a bit more subversive.
It's terrific stuff. It's a kind of child-friendly version of the Viz
yes,
comic,
it is,
I think.
Really, yeah.
A large nod to Spitting Image in
Absolutely,
its concept.
Yeah.
I mean, but I was thinking, I watched an episode of it yesterday when I knew you'd pick this. I was thinking to myself, it almost certainly wouldn't be made today because, you know, today we believe children must be wrapped up and
yes,
kept
absolutely.
Away from, you know, it was such concept, as you say, as a sort of crocodile puppet. People now would say, oh no, that, you know, that might give children some negative views of wildlife or something. And as you said, John Potato's Newsround.
And the endless parodies now sort of treating people respect. They had endless parodies of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and they have one called the Old J's Useless Nitwit Tortoises. Now that's not going to be made now, is it?
Exactly. You know, it's just simply it's simply amazing that in less than a generation we've gone from the ability of having children laugh and be amused by such antics as this. And it's well worth. It's on Tony Husband's website.
Yes,
every
is.
Episode. It's well worth having a look. And I think many of our listeners will be quite astonished to think, my goodness, you know, that was actually on children's.
I know. Watching it now, you think, gosh, I'm surprised. Surprised I was allowed to watch this. It was,
exactly,
but harmless. I mean, it's not, you know.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, no, I'd put it on every day now. I think it'd be fantastic
absolutely.
For children to see.
I
this.
Mean, Wee Man and the Masters of the Looniverse is not gonna. It's not gonna hurt anyone. It really is. It's just a bit pure. That's all.
Absolutely. In second place, I've got Torchy the Battery Boy.
No, I'd never ever heard of this, which is surprising, given who made it.
Exactly. Yeah. We only bought a television when I was 5 or 6 years old, and this was one of the first shows I remember, and it was an early production by Gerry Anderson, who of course went on to create Thunderbirds, Stingray, Captain Scarlet. There was something a bit edgy about Torchy the Battery Boy, and also there was a sort of underlying sense of sadness and emptiness, which I have to say resonated with my childhood, as I said before. Mr. Bumbledrop is all alone, and so he creates a little boy, Torchy, who has this magic beam which he uses to find things, but only as long as his battery lasts. And he's left helpless when his battery runs out. It's a sort of, yeah, it's a sort of metaphor for life, really. Love interest was provided by Flopsy the Rag Doll, who said Piggle Poggle a lot. And I think of Torchy the Battery Boy from time to time, and my big hope is that Torchy the Battery Boy and Flopsy, that they grew up, got married and had several battery-powered Flopsy children of their own.
I think that's something we all hope for, in a way.
Yeah, number two on my list, Torchy the Battery Boy, will, as you say, be a bit of a mystery to anybody under the age of at least 50.
But obviously a neglected part of the Gerry Anderson Canyon.
Yeah, very early, very, very simple kind of staging and puppetry. Very, very simple indeed. But I think you can get some glimmers of what was to come with Thunderbirds and Captain Scarlet.
No, I agree. I think very much so.
Number two on your list. No, number one on your list.
Yes, well,
number one on your list.
Well, yes, I have to say, I very much enjoy this character, really. They've started making new ones now as well, but I'm an enormous fan of Morph. I think that Morph is terrific. Yes. I love the fact that they do an awful lot with an awful little. So there isn't really. Morph doesn't speak. Well, Morph does speak, but not in a way that you can really understand. And he has a friend called Chaz who is also also quite
makes me laugh just thinking about.
Also
them.
Quite subversive as well. And the Morph Aardman Animations do a Morph account on Facebook. You can follow Morph's page on Facebook and follow his adventures. And I often post Morph's pictures of him doing things, pretending that it's me, because I'm deeply inspired by Morph's many adventures. Whoever it is that's doing that is doing a fantastic job. And I mean, obviously, Tony Hart hosting Vision on the outpouring of emotion when Tony Hart died a few years ago. And a friend of mine was involved in organising the Morph flash mob, where a lot of people went down to the South Bank with their own morphs. And there was a sort of a tribute to him, which I thought showed the affection in which he and sort of Vision On. Because Morph started off as an animated slot in Vision On.
Yes.
Before he then went and did some solo work. I love the morph kind of animations so much, because they're often quite clever. And you know, there was I think it was summed up for me how much I enjoy Morph, and it's like subversion in that. Do you remember the Ice Bucket Challenge a couple of years ago?
Yes,
where you had to throw... Well, they did a video of Morph doing the Ice Bucket Challenge with Morph throwing water, and it was only sort of 10 seconds long. And the best thing about it is that because Morph... You can sort of understand Morph, what he said, because he's kind of understanding, but not really. And Morph throws the water over himself, which he absolutely detests, and appears to say, "Oh, my God," except in kind of Morph-type version. And I'm an enormous fan. I think that... I love animation anyway, and I think it's quite telling that everything I've picked, although I love cartoons, I haven't actually picked any cartoons. I've picked slightly sort of different sort of animation, different ways of doing it. But I do think that I love all the albums. I didn't pick Wallace and Gromit because I don't count them to be children's programs. In the same way, I didn't pick The Simpsons because I don't count it to be a children's program. But I think that Aardman Animations kind of innovation of things is best summed up by Morph. And again, you know, Morph manages to be very subversive by not actually being rude. I think that's what I like. I love the idea that although, you know, Round the Bend as well is rather puerile, they're never rude, they're never suggestive. They're just, you know, enormous amounts of fun in a slightly kind of cheeky way, I think.
Terrific choice. Lovely, lovely Morph. It's such an innocent face and full of good intentions.
Which are constantly undermined by his friend as well, Chaz, which is always, always entertaining. We often compare my friend's boyfriend to Chaz because he's quite subversive.
I'm just thinking it. Innocent face and full of good intentions. It's rather like myself.
I was going to say, I consider you more to be the Chaz to my Morph, I must admit, but never mind.
Great theme music and simple escapades. I actually spent, Jules, I spent a happy half hour yesterday watching Morph's YouTube channel.
Oh, yes, it is excellent, isn't it? It's so good.
That's marvellous, yeah. Really great choice. I didn't hesitate when picking my top children's TV show of all time, despite, I have to confess, the very old-fashioned family hierarchy and the fact that they employ a cleaner called Mrs. Scrubbit. Mm. It had to be the Wooden Tops.
Oh, of course, yes.
Again, I'm afraid it's before a lot of people's time, but maybe many of you would have seen repeats.
It has endured, I think. I think a lot of, yeah. I think it's one that really has stood the test of time and still been sort of celebrated.
They lived such happy lives. The only jeopardy was concern that Daddy Wooden Top might be slightly late for lunch because he got held up working on the farm.
Mm.
Mummy Wooden Top bustled about making delicious meals, making sure Baby Wooden Top didn't fall from the cradle, and encouraging the twins, Jenny and Willie Wooden Top, you know, to wash their hands before lunch. And to add to the final layer to what I then, as a sort of five-year-old, saw as family perfection, they had Spotty Dog, who clumped along on his four wooden legs.
Well, they had it, all those people, didn't they?
They really did. They had an idyllic life. They were the very biggest Spotty Dog you ever did see. And to bring some real symmetry into it, the man who held the puppet, acted Spotty Dog, was Gordon Murray, a younger Gordon Murray, who later went on to create Trumpton.
Oh, so, it's the circle of life. There you go. Completely exactly. Back nicely.
Exactly. The Wooden Tops, they gave me a glimpse of a sort of faraway ideal, a sort of utopia where the sun always shone, nobody got old, and they all got together at the end of each show to wave a wooden goodbye to us all at the end of the episode. So Shangri-La in 15 minutes, the Wooden Tops.
That is a fantastic summary, I think.
Hmm. So there's our top three each children's TV shows of all time. You can tell us about yours if you want to tell us about anything you
Absolutely.
Like. Best way to do that, yeah, best way to do that is through Twitter, the social media, at SuperJules84 for Juliet and at Sir Terence for me. Now, Jules, you're not going to be here next week on the podcast, but you've got other public appearances and radio shows
I
to
do,
tell us about.
Yes, I apologize. I seem to be living a perpetual holiday lifestyle at the moment, which
it's an outrage. Frankly, it's an outrage.
I know. Honestly, don't I ever actually bother to do anything? I couldn't even literally phone it in because I don't think there's phone signal where I'm going. But yeah, I've got public appearances. Friday the 5th, Friday the 15th of July. Yes, I will be appearing at the Printworks in Hastings, which is a rather nice sort of bar type venue. Converted Printworks, inevitably, where I'll be DJing as part of Sheila's Take a Bow, and we'll be doing tunes from 8 until 1, so which always feels like you've run a marathon. I must remember not to wear plimsolls on that floor this time, because it's a very... You see, this is the magic and glamour of being a working DJ. Don't wear plimsolls on a wooden floor, because by the end of the evening, you'll want to chop your feet off rather than go anywhere else, because you don't have adequate arch support.
Oh,
that's
I see.
My top
I thought it was to do with the squeakiness,
no,
but it's not.
It's inadequate arch support. I didn't wear my doctor, my DMs, my Dr. Martens.
Oh,
you might
there we
them,
are. It's a lesson in life.
Absolutely.
There we are. We've all learned something today.
Indeed. Yeah. That's what I'm doing. Yep. So, and also radio wise this week, Saturday Social this evening from 6 till 7. Jay in the A to Z. Also doing Indie Wonderland next Wednesday. So we'll have a new track of the month. And we, on the Indie Wonderland Twitter account, we're now into a season of doing different World Cups for different bands. So a series of Twitter polls. So the Radiohead World Cup will start early next week.
Oh,
so we will be catching up with the results of the Radiohead World Cup on the first show.
Huge thanks to Rona, executive producer in Brigadoon.
Yes, indeed. And we always wave cheerily to Rona above where we are.
Thanks to you for listening. If I was a news anchor, I think I'd have to say thank you very much indeed. Thank you for listening.
And you also have to throw it back as well, like Hugh Edwards does. Thank you very much for listening, the audience listening there.
Yes, indeed. Thank you very much indeed. Our closing track, Jules, I think you may be sending us a message of hope here.
Yes, I am sending us a message of hope, as Ringo would put it. Peace and love, peace and love. I this song feels very relevant for me at the moment. We promised not to talk about politics this week, so we won't. But is just a wonderful tune. It was a non-album single by Suede. It was pretty much Bernard Butler's swan song, I think, which is ironic, really, given its title. So this is rather epic style from Suede, and this is Stay Together.
You have been listening to a DAKAM Media production.